Hey, Misha.
Hey, Joe.
Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Joe.
Guys, we recently hit 50,000 downloads of this podcast. That's amazing.
Good job, we also
got a really sweet soundboard. So, first of all, we want to thank all of our great listeners out there who've helped us reach this milestone. Do you guys have anything to add?
Thanks a lot, and it means a lot to us that you download, and we hope that you learn something.
And Jeremy just nodded.
I agree.
So
he concurs.
Beyond that, we want to know what you guys think of this podcast for real. Obviously, you're listening to it, but we don't know if you like it. So what?
You can make it better.
Yeah, you can make it better. And if you don't like it and are listening to it, like, I feel like you're wasting your time a little bit. We could help each other out here. So if you go to neuropodcast.org, we have a survey up. It's at the bottom of the page. Just got to scroll down through all the episodes that we've released. So if you find one that you haven't listened to, you can click on it. You can listen to it. You can listen to it while you do the survey.
And you can listen to it while you work.
Yeah. And you can listen to it while you drive. You can listen to it on the treadmill.
You can listen while you sleep.
You can just play it on a loop. Maybe that's why we're getting 50,000 downloads. Like, people are just playing it and playing it.
But before you like listen to those episodes, fill out our survey.
Yeah. Hit the survey. It's really quick.
You'll be entered to win a Neurotransmissions t-shirt if you want to leave your email. And if you don't, we're not going to take your info. We don't care. We just, you know, we want to know if you like it and what you want to do.
And if you leave your email, we probably won't use it for like
evil purposes. We definitely won't use it for anything else.
We definitely won't use it for evil purposes.
For any purposes.
Got it.
So that email will be used to get you your t-shirt. It's the new t-shirt. It's really soft. It's a sort of like blend of different fabrics, whatever. Fill out the survey, listen to more episodes, and we'll see you soon. Hello and welcome to another episode of Max Planck Florida's Neurotransmissions podcast. I'm Joe Schumacher and I'm joined by first-time co-host Jeremy Chang. Jeremy, how are you doing?
Good.
So long-time listeners of the podcast have heard Jeremy's voice before. He's often at the top of the episode telling you about what you're about to hear. But Jeremy, tell us a little bit about what you do, what your role at the Institute is.
Well, I'm a postdoc in the Fitzpatrick Lab, and I've been studying the early development of the visual system. And I actually started out as a electrical engineer with an interest in optics and fell into neuroscience.
Cool. Thank you for helping with all the good work you're doing editing the podcast and everything. Jeremy has turned this ship around, and a lot of the productivity that we're having is due directly to him. So kudos to you. So let's talk about today's episode. We have a really great guest on the show today, Dr. Yuri Buzhaki, a professor from NYU, is here to talk about, not just his research, it's actually a quite wide-ranging discussion, but he's one of the foremost hippocampal researchers in the field of neuroscience, focused heavily on oscillatory patterns of activity in the brain. We'll hear a little bit about that today, for sure.
And we'll also hear a little bit about how he's approaching the brain in a different way than most people, using a inside-out perspective.
Yeah. So the conversation is really interesting. We get to get a little bit of a different flavor of how people approach problems in neuroscience in general, I think. So without further ado, here is our interview. So today we're very honored to have on the podcast a giant in the field of neuroscience. He is the Biggs Professor of Neuroscience, Physiology, and Neurology at NYU School of Medicine. He's the recipient of many awards and recognitions, far too many to list, but they include an elected member of the National Academy of Sciences, the prestigious Brain Prize, and one of the most highly cited neuroscientists in the world, in the top 1% of cited neuroscientists. He's the author of Rhythms of the Brain and the new book, The Brain from Inside Out. Dr. Yuri Buzhaki, thank you for joining us today.
I'm very happy to be here.
So we've covered a lot of topics on the podcast before, but one of the topics we haven't really talked about is rhythmic activity in the brain and oscillations in the brain. So I thought maybe we could start with, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what type of rhythmic activity happens in the brain and sort of how you got into looking at that.
In every system where you would like to convey information, the most important thing is to package that information. Packaging requires some kind of a stop signal. The reason why we understand each other is because the way we speak has certain type of rhythmicity. If this whole podcast would be one single word, it would be very difficult to decipher the content. So it just happens that in order to segment information and have a stop signal, you need solutions, and rhythms are perfect solutions for that. The reason why this, they are perfect solution that is because every single oscillator or every single rhythm in the brain known is based on inhibition. So inhibition comes as a natural full stop to a word or to a sentence or to a paragraph. And there are many different types of these oscillations, just like the many different types of pauses in information transmission, such as human language. These patterns give you short packages, long packages, and so on. So let's start with the famous pattern called gamma oscillation, which is about a period of about 1 to 30 milliseconds. Now, in this 130 millisecond, you can bring about many neurons that can fire together with one and only one goal, which is to discharge a postsynaptic target neuron. Now, the postsynaptic target neurons are listening with their capacity, which is expressed by the membrane time constant, if I may use this word. That is the capacity or ability of the postsynaptic neuron to integrate over time. So everybody who was firing together in this 30 millisecond and is connected to this neuron will be lumped together and said, this is one unit. You can use it, you can call it a neuronal word. Now, those neurons that missed the 30 millisecond time window, they fire 60 millisecond, at 70 millisecond, they automatically should belong to another entity or another word or another cell assembly. So now that's the fundamental, let's say, message of information in this gamma cycle. You can concatenate these gamma cycles into many of them, and it's done by, or can be done, by a slow oscillation. It turns out that there are multiple oscillators. I listed 12 of them. And they are not only many different types and different mechanisms and different durations, but they form a beautiful system. And the beautifulness or the beauty of it comes from the fact that they form a progression on a natural logarithmic scale, which also means a couple of interesting things, namely that if it's a natural logarithmic scale, then the neighboring frequencies are not integers of each other, but they are connected through an irrational number, which means that they can never settle. They always interfere with each other. So what happens is two things, just to step back a little bit. Mm-hmm. A slow oscillation is capable of modulating the amplitude of a faster oscillation. The phase of a faster oscillation is capable of modulating the amplitude of an even faster oscillation. And it goes ad infinitum from one slower to an intermediate to a faster and a faster and a faster. It is a bit like the ocean waves, that there is a big ocean waves and there are these little ripples, and the little ripples are modulated by the phase of this big wave. Or I can give you another example. The moon and the earth. We know that there are different phases of the moon and there are different times of the day and so on. And you look at what happens in the oceans, and the oceans go up and down the level. And that's a phase modulation, because it's the moon's phase, modulating the amplitude of the ocean. So this is called phase amplitude modulation. Also in neuroscience, we also call it cross-frequency phase coupling. So now this is good, it's cool, but there is also the timing that I already mentioned. So it seems that there is a natural mechanism in the brain that allows you to give a thing that we need for every information system called syntax. So in summary, or in short, the best and perhaps most important thing that neural rhythms are about is giving you a neuronal syntax. You want to dig in into this, or should I continue? What else we should know about rhythms, or
I guess you
want to have questions along, in this?
Yeah, I mean, along the lines of like sort of putting it in the context of, you know, our sort of everyday existence. I mean, one thing that you hear about, and, you know, I'm certainly no expert, but you sort of hear about different, you know, frequency rhythms being associated with different brain states or that sort of thing. I mean, how, to what extent is that true? And like, what are some examples of how, you know, our current situation in our brain is influenced by the oscillations?
So brain states are very easy to characterize by the distribution of the power of the different oscillators. For example, there are particular patterns that are very characteristic and happens only during non-REM sleep. These are called up and down states, also called slow oscillation. Now, the slow oscillation is interesting because this is being modulated by an even slower pattern, which is about 0.1 hertz, which is the famous Bold signal fluctuation in the fMRI signal. So now you've got a very slow signal that is modulating this other slow signal. Is called slow 3, the other one is slow 1. And from then the up and down states go on and modulate another sleep-specific pattern called thalamocortical sleep spindles. Now, the thalamocortical sleep spindles are also good because they are thalamocortical and they are spread all over the entire thalamocortical system, but they also reach the hippocampus where they can modulate another pattern called hippocampal ripples. So any of these things can be correlated with each other, but they form a hierarchical system the way I just described. So this is what happens during sleep. For example, during waking pattern, something different occurs in the hippocampus. There are no longer these very fast 200 hertz ripple oscillations. Instead, there is another pattern called theta oscillation that I talked about a little bit today. It's about 6-7 hertz up to about 10 hertz. That modulates the gamma oscillation. So the gamma-theta coupling is a good example of how you concatenate neural letters to neuronal words. And I showed you several examples today when the animal was running in a wheel. There are these long sequences. All of them are expressions of these concatenated patterns from which you can have a group of neurons firing together in a short slot and another group of neurons in another slot, and many of these slots can be concatenated. And it's a little bit different from human speech, is because what happens that after each theta cycle, you repeat the sentence again with a slightly different variation that you lose the end and you have a new beginning. Then it would be like, I say a sentence, and then I say the same sentence with one word less and one more word, and so on. And it keeps going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So unlike in human speech, in the hippocampus, we say things 10 times, or actually 7 plus minus 2 times. And this is also good because this is the way how plasticity can occur. You repeat, 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 repeat. Part of the information is repeated with the help of this cross-frequency phase coupling mechanism.
So if we could back up for 1 second, you've sort of gotten to the meat of a lot of what we want to talk about today, which is hippocampus. In a previous episode of this podcast, we talked to Edvard Moser about his contributions to understanding, you know, how different types of cells contribute to representations of our place in the world that facilitate navigation. Now, you gave a very inspiring and provocative talk today that sort of turned that on its head a little bit and framed the hippocampus in a completely, I would say, different way. And it sort of gets to, I think, what is going to be sort of a central message of your new book, this sort of looking at the brain from inside out, outside in. So if we could start talking a little bit about that perspective. I think, you know, what have you seen as a main limitation of certain dogmatic ways of thinking about hippocampus or the brain in general that you think there are other ways around?
Brain research is a little bit like the Wild West, as we discussed with the student today. You know, you can find so many things. The most important message in my lab or the things we like to say is that it's impossible to find nothing. So there is no good way and bad way, at least currently in neuroscience, how you approach it. So I have no complaints about what other people do because they generate enormous amount of knowledge. And what the Mosers you just mentioned, what they contributed to the field is just unbelievably fantastic and beautiful. The moment I read about the grid cells or learned about them, I was mesmerized, as many of us are, because it shows an extraordinary beauty. And you like to understand beauty and you like to understand the mechanism of beauty, especially if it serves something. So now you can analyze it in various different ways. One of them is looking at what people have known about this structure or thought about this structure. And it was mostly in the framework of spatial navigation. So immediately when you have a new finding, you would like to put it in a historical perspective. And that's the easiest and perhaps most natural one. I was never thrilled about this because most of it for me was phenomenology. I was more interested in how certain things inside the brain serve what we make up. And when you look at the hippocampus as a spatial map, you cannot help asking other questions. That, well, wait a second, how do we go from a map, I mean, rodent navigation, to episodic memories in humans served by the same structures? And the easiest way to do that is that, oh, the rodent is a rodent, the human is a human, there are different solutions, we are much better, much smarter, and so on. That cannot be right, of course. You have to have some evolutionary background, and there is no big jump in evolution, so you do something else. And as I try to convince everybody today, it's the same algorithm that goes on in both types of behaviors. One is more based on the external environment, and this dependence of the external environment is what is inherited from our ancestors, mostly philosophers, and from psychologists and cognitive scientists, and then become neuroscientists. And without deeply thinking that those historically inherited terms and framework are actually right, we don't necessarily ask the question, we just say, oh, I found something that fits into this framework. But interestingly, in the past 10 years, I would say, or 5 years, we got to a tension. The tension is about, it's no longer the hippocampus is about space, but all of a sudden it's about time or so. And then once you got here, you say, how do I figure out which one is right or which one is wrong?
So is that what you mean then about sort of the outside in way of looking at the brain, is how does the outside world impose its order onto our structures?
And this is our tradition, as I mentioned today, is that the history of this, that we view the brain as a device that is given to you by God to learn about the truth. And only through the brain, well, of course, the Bible didn't mention anything about the brain, but the mind is there to figure out the truth. And the way how we learn it is to carefully listen, analyze, absorb. And that's what is the general assumption is that, the brain is associating things, and this is how you go from associations and absorption to a point where you evaluate the good and the bad, the important and the non-important. And the consequence of this philosophy is an inevitable middle part of the brain, which should be called decision-making or the will or consciousness or many of those complicated things that are inevitable consequence of this philosophy. There is no way to go from sensation to complicated sensory inputs and associations to motor actions except through this homunculus, this construct. And this is where you start thinking whether this is the right way to think about it or not. And the opposite way is to go in a different directions for a simple practical reason, namely that we know that our framework and our vocabulary determines how we think. But if we change the way how we approach to the vocabulary and say, maybe I can understand this relationship between out and in a different way, taking the brain as the independent variable and see how it classifies the world. And it makes more sense to me because the goal of the brain is not to learn the radical truth out there, but the goal of the brain is only to help the body and to make survive and learn and predict what is useful for the organism. Whether it's about the true nature of the world or not, doesn't matter. How do I know that my view of the world is any closer to the truth than that of a bat or that of the view of a fly? We don't exactly know.
So before I interrupted you, you started talking about how there's now sort of a shift in hippocampal literature about talking about the hippocampus is for space versus the hippocampus is for time. You know, our perception of space, our perception of time, I think as you illustrated today, are sort of ideas that we have about what the brain is supposed to be doing that are sort of rooted in old ways of thinking or this sort of
empiricist way. You just said the words, the perception of time, perception of space. In order to perceive something, you need sensors. We don't have sensors for either space or time. Everything, you cannot understand space or time on first principles. You have to use something else. There is something that we can understand, which is speed or velocity, because we have receptors for that. And so if you have receptors for that, then this is why I was looking and giving examples how we can convert one concept to another concept if we used first principles. And I think this is very important every now and then. In every walks of life in neuroscience, we go back and said, is this a correlation of a construct? Or is this something that is absolutely real? And I try to illustrate is that in order to make space and time useful, you have to have instruments that are measuring this. And this is the interesting thing that comes back all the time when I talk about this, that is it useful to talk about time and space? Of course it is useful, super useful. There's no way you can have any intelligent conversation and an intelligent measurement in the lab without these constructs. But it's a totally different attitude to say that I'm looking at the temporal differences between events. Therefore, that structure's goal is to represent time or represent space. I hope you see the difference that one thing is an attitude and then the practice. The other one is a deeper philosophy, whether we can associate or we can assign certain roles to certain mechanisms.
So one of the discussions that we had had coming out of your talk was a question of whether the thinking about the brain from the perspective inside out is sort of a the way the brain actually works, or if it's a framework for thinking. So we talked a little bit about this, the notion of wave-particle duality in physics, where electrons are often thought of as waves because they behave like waves under certain circumstances, and in other circumstances, they behave like particles. And depending on the circumstance, you choose how you're going to analyze it. Is that the sort of what you're
advocating
here?
A little bit
here?
Of both. So I can say the inside-out is a practical solution. It's a comfort zone choice that I'd like to know whether the measurements I do is actually useful. For example, I work a lot on oscillations. I work a lot on LFPs. Do I believe that local field potentials are actually brain mechanisms and they are useful for something? Of course not. The brain doesn't use local field potentials, but it's a very useful measure. It's like a cardiologist listens to your heart and it says, okay, you are in danger because I hear something, but that sound is not used by the system. So one level, working my way from inside out, said, I know that understanding theta oscillation is an important thing because it's there in every single mammal. So it's a belief that it may be useful for something. And if I dedicate my entire life figuring out what are the mechanism of this pattern, I don't waste my life. Whereas if I associate hippocampal theta oscillations with 500 different words that have been already associated in the past 100 years with this pattern, I don't know which of the 100 is closest to the reality. So this is the practical part. The deeper part or the strategy part is that brains, as I, again, I go back to the brains are not there to represent anything. The brains are there to help survival of the body. Now, how do you do that? The way you do that is you generate patterns all the time. Some of these will become outputs, and these output patterns can change the way how we look at the world. And the brain's goal is to look at how your behavior and the consequences of behavior will be perceived by the brain. What is the feedback that is caused by the you do anything with the world? I think it's a upside down way of thinking. But this is probably the right way of approaching it, because you don't start out with a huge baggage of words and phrases that are imposed on you. You are starting with an honest curiosity, and you say, this is the way I like to go from inside out. So inside out also means something else for me, because the inside for me is the hippocampus. I don't start with giving signals from the outside world, but I'd like to see how the hippocampus organizes activity of the neocortex, and how the neocortical activity in different regions are interacting with each other. Of course, in a context of some behavior, but I'd like to understand that classification of those words which you use for describing behavior from an independent point of view. Okay, so let's go back to the internally organized patterns. So the brain organizes many, many patterns. This is already a interesting thing, because the outside-in approach would say that the brain is a tabula rasa. It's a blank slate. And no self-respecting neuroscientist would ever admit that the brain is a blank slate, yet in the laboratory we follow that philosophy. Now, so you can say that the reason why there are so many patterns in the brain is because we learn a lot of things. If that would be the case, then the number of patterns that you can identify in the hippocampus or in the brain would scale with experience. But I can pose the question whether the number of sequences in my hippocampus are more or less than yours. Or Albert Einstein has more than I do? And my answer is the same. The important thing is that there are so many already existing patterns that allows you to balance the dynamic of the brain. You don't have to create anything new. What you do is you match one of these or some of these patterns with experience. So for me, the brain is a dictionary with a lot of nonsense words that are already there in a pre-existing format. And you, with experience, you assign meaning to each of these existing patterns rather than making up new patterns. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this would be like your brain is spontaneously active without any external stimuli.
Exactly. And you're trying to exactly. So in the extreme form, I would say if my brain would be examined by you, without any experience in my life, but it matured to the level, maybe you wouldn't be able to find enormous differences in terms of the oscillatory patterns, in terms of almost anything, because it sustained itself as a dynamic system. But it is a useless piece of tissue because it is not associated with anything useful. But usefulness or utility or meaning is acquired through experience.
So, you know, you've mentioned that like the goal of the brain is to support the body, to support behaviors that will provide good outcomes for survival and things like that. So from this perspective, learning then is just updating the brain's internal model of how to go from like need to fulfillment. Is that sort of
exactly? Okay. So learning for me is a matching process. You don't have to generate patterns. We have more patterns than we need. In fact, the rodent hippocampus already generates unbelievable number of patterns. But the information or the value is not in the generator. The information is always in the reader. The question is how these patterns are interpreted by the neocortex. And if you accept that, then there is an easy answer to the question, how come that the hippocampus doesn't grow proportionally with the neocortex? In the primate brain, the hippocampus is much, much, much smaller, relatively speaking, than the large neocortex. And the answer is that richness of the information is not in the sender, it's always in the reader.
this flew by really fast. We're sort of running towards the end of this, and you know, one thing that strikes us both, we were talking about this after your talk, is that you know, we were, you know, ready for a talk on, you know, hippocampus, and we felt like we came away with like almost a philosophical approach to science that was drawing on Immanuel Kant and, you know, the history of philosophy. So, I mean, do you have, I mean, you're clearly a person of sort of wide reading and, you know, very varied interests. Do you, I mean, is this sort of an approach that you take just, you know, in your normal life as a scientist to just explore lots of diverse interests? Is this something that you encourage your students and advisees to do and things like that?
I like to read mostly outside from my field. I learned a lot more from physics and language, engineering than from neuroscience. When you talk to another neuroscience, then our overlap is enormous. When you are talking about ripples, then you are talking about somebody who is working on the LIGO project. All of a sudden, we find some common words used in differently and probably new insights. But that's an individual taste, whether you are willing to go and read. I'm not interested in philosophy. I'm interested in understanding the brain. And it just happened that I had to go to dig and dig deeper in order to address those uncertainties that I had to face. And you know, if you would be working in the hippocampus these days, where one group of people say one thing, another group of people say something different, then how do you proceed? And one way of doing it is just side with one of them or think deeper and say, oh, how did we get here? And in order to know how we get here, we have to look at how we were 100 years ago.
Just before we go, is there anything sort of pressing in the world of neuroscience that you think we should be talking about that the field in general should be aware of that's going on?
So our field is pretty complex. Gathering data and analyzing data is an enormous venture. It usually takes 4 or 5 years to a student or postdoc to generate enough data to answer a simple question. And in many cases, it's not answerable because we don't have enough. So one way of doing that is sharing our data with other laboratories. And this is something we have started about 6 years ago. Now we have a dedicated group of people. Everybody buys in. Nobody is scared that anybody will scoop you and take the data. So every single time we publish a paper, all the data, all of them, if you want even the original wideband data available for the public, we have over 1,000 data sets available, which is larger than all data sets combined by all other laboratories at the moment. And I would encourage other groups to do the same. Very soon, we hope we will put up also our analysis tools with the goal that anybody, anywhere in the world, can contradict us and improve the representation of those data that we produced.
So they can find this just by going to your website?
Correct.
Great. Cool. Well, Dr. Boujaki, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For this week's episode, we'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Boujaki. And if you're interested in finding that open data set that Dr. Boujaki mentioned at the end of the episode, you can find that at boujakilab.com.
Yeah, we want to know what you guys think. What do you think of this inside-out approach to understanding what the brain is doing? You can find us on all the usual social media spots, and let us know what you think. So until next time, take care.
Thank you for listening to Neurotransmissions. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and now on Spotify. Connect with us on Twitter at Neuropodcast and at facebook.com/neuropodcast. This has been a production of the Max Planck Florida Institute for Neuroscience.
All right, thanks for listening. Don't forget to take our survey at neuropodcast.org. It'll help make the show even better, and you could win a t-shirt. Not just any t-shirt with Neurotransmissions logo on it. Visit neuropodcast.org, scroll all the way to the bottom, and click on a survey.